Okay, boker tov, everybody. It's 11 a.m. in Toronto, Canada, and 6 p.m. in Alon Shvut, where Shuli Mishkin is. On behalf of Torah Motion, I want to welcome you to another one of our Zoom E-Team, the Torah in Motion Beit Midrash. And it's a pleasure to do something. We can't go to Israel. We can't travel to Israel, most of us who are living here, but we'll do virtual tours. Shuli Mishkin made Aliyah in 1997, has a master's degree in Jewish history, has been running tours for many, many years. And with Matan, Pardes, Darkenu, for special needs children, kids. And so obviously with the lack of tourism, we can make a virtual tour almost as good as a real tour. So we're happy to present this four-part series and Bakasha, and we look forward to seeing Israel through the lens of our computer. Becca Shah.
Okay, hi everybody. First of all, nice to see so many faces and names that I recognize, both from Canada, from New York, from Israel. So thank you all for joining. And thank you, Rabbi Kelman and Torah in Motion for the opportunity. It's really something exciting. And we are gonna dive right in. So the way this is gonna work is like this. I am going to be sharing my screen. And we're really going to be looking at pictures the whole time, because that's the main thing that's going on here. At the end, obviously, I will go out of there, and we will have time for questions and everything like that. But just give me a second to get it on. Okay. What we are doing is we are going to do a four-part series on Tanakh, on Bible, and archaeology. And today's first one is going to be about King David, who's maybe one of the most controversial kind of lightning rod figures in this whole question of Tanakh and archaeology. And it's a good way to start and to do a little bit of an introduction for this whole topic. Okay, so as we're waiting for the slideshow to begin, it's coming on in a second. Since archaeology began, meaning 19th century, gets more prominent in the 20th century, you have this question, does it prove the Bible? Does it not prove the Bible? The pendulum swings back and forth. Many of the very first archaeologists were religious Christians, okay, religious text-knowing Christians, okay, people like Charles Warren, like Charles Wilson, okay, like Edward Robinson, and who are coming and who are saying, I know my Bible, and I want to know, is it proven through the archaeology, right? And we're going to go through a few people and look a little bit at the history of archaeology. But like I said, one of these lightning rod figures really is King David, okay? First of all, because later Tanakh stories, let's say towards the end of First Temple times, King Hezekiah, the Assyrians, those stories, we have much more archaeology. Earlier, we have less, but also because King David is so important, is so significant, both in Jewish history, in Christian history. King David is such a gigantic figure in the Bible that he really is somebody that a lot of this controversy centers around. So he's a good person to start with, just if you're curious where the cover photo is from. Okay, this is a great mosaic from a synagogue in Gaza, right, in Gaza, from the early Middle Ages, from the 6th century. And you can see, if you didn't know who it was, if the crown didn't give it away, it says David in Hebrew letters up here, right? It says David. And it shows him playing the harp. The interesting detail about this mosaic, by the way, is all the animals, right? You can see the animals, some of it's cut off, but the animals are coming to listen. And this is a great merging of Jewish tradition and Greek traditions, because King David is King David, of course, playing the harp. We know that from the Bible, but he's also depicted here a little bit as the Greek figure Orpheus, right? Whose music brings the animals. That's nothing to do with our story, but it's just interesting to know about. Let's take a look at some of the early archaeologists. Let's take some poster children to give us a sense of the trajectory of this story. Okay, so one of the first real archaeologists, when I say real archaeologists as opposed to treasure hunters, right, there were a lot of people who showed up in various places in the 18th and the 19th century, basically just looking for treasure, for statues, for impressive things. didn't really understand anything or contribute anything to what was the growing science of archaeology. Sir William Flinders Petrie is one of the pioneers in archaeology. He was an Englishman who looks kind of very stuffy in this picture, but he really wasn't. He actually committed the cardinal sin of digging in Egypt in his undershirt, as opposed to wearing a three-piece suit, which a lot of other people did in those days. Okay. And he goes and he digs in Egypt, he digs in the land of Israel. He contributes enormously to the field, not because of what he discovers, even though he discovers some very important things, including an inscription that's the first time we have the name Israel as a nation, something called the Merneptah Stela. He's the one who discovers it. But that's not really his contribution to archaeology. His contribution is in two things that we hear them today. If we know a little about archaeology, we say, oh, that's obvious. It wasn't obvious, right? Sir Flinders Petrie is the first one who comes along and says, you have to look at the stratigraphy. What is stratigraphy? Stratigraphy is a fancy way of saying the layer cake, right? If you have layers of a site, a tell, what we call a tell, if you have layers upon layers, then the ones at the bottom are earlier, the ones at the top are later. And you say, that's so intuitive. Of course, that's obvious, but nobody said it before him and nobody understood it before him. So instead of just kind of digging through and looking for the treasure, he wanted to understand the layers. Okay, tied into that is his other great contribution where he looks at pottery. And he says, we can figure out, we can date something based on the pottery. How can we do that? Because if we have a layer that we know when it's from the style, from something we found somewhere else, maybe from an inscription, anytime we find pottery that looks like that somewhere else, we know that that's from that time, right? Our classic example would be, right, I do an archaeological dig in my mother's kitchen in 500 years and I find Corel. Find Corel, I say, okay, this is a kitchen that's from 1985 to 2000, give or take, right? We know when these things were, okay? So his identification of pottery, using kind of a dictionary of pottery and stratigraphy, it makes archaeology more of a science. Now, he also is always looking for proof of Tanakh, for proof of the Bible. And that's really what most of these earlier guys are, but he's starting to do it in a scientific sort of a way. Okay. Continuing, we have other Christian archaeologists, chief among them, somebody named William Albright, who is in the land of Israel. He comes to the land of Israel. He has a school here. Many of his students become the first real archaeologists in Israel. And he's also very much a religious man, very connected to the Bible. The next generation are the Israeli archaeologists, right? Archaeologists who are born in Israel or came here at a young age, studied here, dig here under the auspices of the state of Israel. And one of the most famous ones, right, a real rock star archaeologist, is somebody named Yigael Yadin. Right? Yigael Yadin is most famous probably for digging Masada. And he also is one of the guys who is involved with the Bar Kokhba caves and the treasures from there. His father was a famous archaeologist, Eliezer Sukenik, right? Also very important biblical archaeologist. But Yigael Yadin, who was not in any way a religious man, not Christian, not Jewish, he wasn't religious. He was a very modern Israeli in that sense, in the sense of the 1940s and the 1950s. He says, I dig with the Bible in one hand and with a spade in the other. He totally saw the Tanakh as a source for his digs and whatever he dug up in archaeology, he looked in Tanakh to understand, right? Very famous example. We'll come to it a little later in the series when we talk about King Solomon's cities, but he dug in two out of the three of the cities that the Bible ascribes to King Solomon besides Jerusalem, right? Gezer, he didn't dig there, Megiddo and Hatzor. And when he digs in Hatzor, he digs the gate area and he says, you know what? I know that the gate area in Megiddo looks like this. It's six chambers, it's six rooms. And he actually sketches it in the dirt for his workers. He says, dig here and this is what you're gonna find. Why? Because King Solomon built Megiddo. King Solomon built the Hatzor. It must be the same architect. And they dig and they find it. It does look the same, right? Pretty wild. So Yigael Yadin is very much holding by the Bible as a source, okay? And that's the generation of Israeli archaeologists of the 50s, of the 60s, even into the 70s. And that's when the change happens, right? The pendulum swings in the other direction. Now we have a lot of archaeologists we could bring. I brought Professor Finkelstein because he's really kind of the poster child for this story. But before we get to him, we'll just talk for a minute about a very famous article written in Hebrew in the early 80s by somebody named Ze'ev Herzog, who basically said There is no proof for Tanakh until the very, very late period of the Bible.
Or, in fact, that Israel is
involved in the
business.
There is no, he says, there's no proof. There's no proof for the Exodus. There's no proof for Joshua. There's certainly no proof for the patriarchs and matriarchs. It's all stuff that was written down much later. King Arthur, fairy tales, whatever you want to call it, there is nothing there. Okay, and that's a very extreme position, a minimalist position. Professor Finkelstein is not quite as minimalist, but he does say that a lot of what was written down about King David, King Solomon, is written much later and ascribing back into history these mythical characters to these figures. And this is what we call minimalism, okay? And there's also issues of chronology. When were things, when do we date things, right? How do we date certain cities, certain walls? Again, going back to Petrie, and basically saying that this whole very majestic era described in the Bible of King David and King Solomon never happened. Okay, we're going to come back to that, but that's the swing of the pendulum in the 80s and 90s, very much to minimalism. Okay, and then we come to the last 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. Okay, and the example I brought here was Eilat Mazar. Okay, Eilat Mazar is a scion of an archaeology family. She's archaeology royalty. Her grandfather was Binyamin Mazar. He dug in by the southern wall excavations right after the Six-Day War in Jerusalem. Her cousin is Ami Mazar. He's also a very well-known archaeologist. And she digs in places like the City of David, the Ophel, right near where the Kotel, where the Western Wall is. And she basically says, if we find it and it doesn't contradict the Bible and it fits with the Bible, it fits with the Bible. And she often will say, I'm going to find something that the Bible talks about. The pendulum swinging in the other direction. And many other archaeologists are also coming along and speaking like her and saying, well, wait a second, you can't just completely take away everything that the Bible says just because the Bible says it, okay? Dr. Joshua Berman, I think he spoke for you, or maybe he will be speaking for you. He says that, you know, if we called the Bible the Library of the Ancient Near East, it would have a lot more credibility because it's the Bible, because it's so loaded religiously, politically, right? And of course, the whole conflict of Arabs and the Israelis is connected in here. Because it's so loaded, it's hard for people to take it as a source, and yet it's such an important source. But Eilat Mazar is saying, no, 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 we do have to take it as a source. And today, like we say, the pendulum is swinging back and forth. Today, it's somewhere in the middle, but many sites are being uncovered that are making people say, but wait a second. David and Solomon, maybe not quite as grand as the Bible describes it, but definitely not nothing. Okay, so that's, we're going to try to walk that middle ground in the site that we're going to look at, Kayafa. That's the case study we're going to look at. Before we get there, just a couple of very important things. First of all, the theory that there was no King David, that King David was kind of this mythical King Arthur-ish figure that was written about later on and made up, was totally, the lie was put to it in the early 90s. Right? There's an excavation going on that had gone on for about four decades in the north, a place called Tel Dan, okay? Tel Dan, not so far from Kiryat Shmona, if you know your way around Israel. Abraham Biran dug there for more than 30 years. And at a certain point, they found a piece, these two pieces of this monumental stela, this monumental inscription. You know a little of your old Hebrew, you can see the old Hebrew letters. This is actually not a stela that was written by us, by the Israelites. This was written by the Arameans, by Hazael, the king of Aram. But what's fascinating about it, and you'll see this right now, is what's highlighted here. It wasn't highlighted in the original, okay? But it says, Ben, okay? Bet Nun, right? Ben David, Beit David, excuse me, Beit David, okay? Actually, very nice letters, very clear letters. The X is a taf, the triangles, the deltas are dalids, Beit David. Now, if there is a Beit David, this stela is dated very clearly because it has the king of Aram's name on it. It's from the 9th century before the Common Era. We tend to date King David to the 10th century before the Common Era, i.e. 100 years earlier, right? BCE, we go backwards, a little confusing always, okay? If this is a stela that talks about the house of David in the 9th century, 100 years or so after we talk about David, then there was David, right? Nobody's writing a house of David if nobody had ever heard of David. So except for some real outliers, basically everybody agrees that there was a King David. Now the question is, okay, so how great, how strong, at what point, right? What can we know about King David? And that's what we're gonna try and explore. But just to get our dates for a second, okay, King David, 10th century, meaning 1000 before the Common Era, okay? And we're also talking about the Iron Age. And we're gonna talk about the transition from what's called Iron One, okay, the less sophisticated, more rural. When we talk about ages, bronze, iron, right? We're just talking about the material that's used for tools. So Iron One at some point shifts to Iron Two, more urban, more centralized government. When does that happen? And is that connected to King David? Keep those in the back of your head. Don't worry if you've forgotten them already. Okay. Before we move on to our specific case, one of the things I think is important to refute is what Ze'ev Herzog wrote about in the 80s. He says there's no proof. He says there's no evidence. And this is an argument from silence, right? Basically saying if we haven't found it, it doesn't exist. And I just want to show you in the next minute or so a couple of examples of things that nobody would have ever expected to find. Archaeology, certainly archaeology in the land of Israel, is full of surprises all the time. And to say we haven't found it, you really have to say we haven't found it yet. We might never find it, but things are always turning up. So one example here are these ostraca, right? Ostraca are basically broken pieces of pottery. In the old days, you didn't waste anything. Everything was used. You didn't throw it away. You used it as your scrap paper. You used it as your back of an envelope to write a draft of something. And as you can see, they are covered in writing. And these ostraca were discovered already in the 60s in Tel Arad in the south. They are letters that were written, that were drafts of letters that were written by the commander of this fortress down in the periphery on the very edge of the land of Israel. And it's very interesting what he writes about and all the different things that was studied. But very recently, Professor Finkelstein, actually, of all people, his students did a further study. And what they studied was the handwriting. They looked carefully at the handwriting of all these ostraca, because there are a lot of them, and they noticed that there was not one handwriting. There was many different handwritings. What does that mean? That means that soldiers on the periphery, in a fortress, on the edge of nowhere, quite a lot of them know how to read and write, okay? This is from the 6th century before the Common Era, and it's telling you there's widespread literacy, which the Bible really pretty much assumes. We have stories that talk about people knowing how to read and write. But if you have widespread literacy, then the fact that you might have written down a book is a much more commonplace idea, is a much more acceptable idea. So that's something that was newly discovered, that's exciting. Another literacy proof, this is another piece of a scrap paper, basically, from a place called Izbit Sarta. In Hebrew, it's Evan Ha'ezer, today very right on the outskirts of Rosh Ha'ayin in central Israel. And basically what it is what we think it is. We don't really know, right? It's some kind of a writing exercise. The only part that's very clear what it is, all of it is letters, but the part that's the clearest is the bottom here, which is an alphabet, right? It's an alphabet that's not actually in the order that our alphabet is in. It's a few letters are out of shape, but this is the earliest alphabet we have. So again, is this a child's homework, right? Was it a writing exercise? We don't know. But again, it shows us literacy on a level that perhaps we would not have expected. If everyone's assuming this is an oral society, you wouldn't write down books. Think again, okay? Going in a completely different direction. About 30 years ago, an archaeologist, kind of a maverick archaeologist named Adam Zertal, who did a massive survey of Samaria, of the excavation, of the archaeology and the sites in Samaria after the Six-Day War, he discovered on a mountain right near Shechem, Mount Ebal. Some of you may be familiar with the blessings and the curses, right? Har Gerizim, Har Ebal, Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal. We hear about it in the book of Deuteronomy. We also hear about it in the book of Joshua, where Joshua goes and does what God says, right? He does this whole blessings and curses of the valley between the two mountains, and he builds an altar on Mount Ebal. And Adam Zartal uncovered this site, which has many elements of an altar. It has a ramp, it has corners. It has bones of kosher animals buried underneath, right? If this fascinates you, I'm doing a Zoom tour next week of the Book of Joshua. I'm not going to go into it too much here. But basically, if you're saying Joshua and all those stories of conquest and settlement, fairy tales, what do you do with this? Which has Egyptian scarabs, which date it to the 12th century before the Common Era. Now, I'm not saying that all of these things say everything in Tanakh we have proof for, but it's unexpected information that changes our approach. And if you want to go for the biggest surprise discovery, probably of all time yet, the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you had told somebody 100 years ago that in a cave in the middle of nowhere, in 11 caves in the middle of nowhere, you would find 2,200-year-old scrolls that have copies of the Bible as well as this bizarro sect of Judaism, nobody would believe you. But yet, here they are, and they are a huge wealth of information. So an argument from silence doesn't work very well. Okay? And we really have to take the evidence as it comes. But now we're going to come back to King David. So you have two pictures here. The map on the left is a picture of the kingdom, the United Kingdom of Israel. King David, we're going to forget about Saul right now because his story is much more complicated. But King David, as it's portrayed in the Bible, meaning it's a very large and expansive kingdom. In fact, in Tanakh, it's even more expansive because eventually he conquers the area of the Arameans, but very large and expansive with its capital in Jerusalem. This is the way the Bible portrays it. Along come the minimalists and say, what are you talking about? King David might have existed. We found that, you know, stela that says House of David. But if anything, he was a little tribal chieftain. Maybe he ruled over, you know, a couple of small villages around Jerusalem. What are you talking about that he had cities all over the place and he had an army that could conquer the Philistines, et cetera, et cetera? Bubamisis doesn't make any sense, right? And that was the minimalist approach. Today, and that's the picture here you have here on the right, this is from National Geographic. Some people who are National Geographic fans might recognize the style. And National Geographic, about 10 years ago, a little bit more, did a cover story on King David. Why? Because of the site we are going to get to in another minute, the site called Kayafa, which I will show you on this map, right? We're basically asking, was King David for real, right? And basically what they did is they said, let's look at a few sites that are starting to show us that maybe there's more to the story than the minimalists have said. So we have this House of David that we mentioned already up here in Tel Dan, okay? We have the cities of Solomon. We're not going to talk about that right now. That's for another time. We have Kayafa, which the city of two gates, which is what we're going to spend our time talking about now. And Jerusalem, the city of David, okay, what was discovered there by Elat Mazar, and a very intriguing site, which we're not really going to talk about, but has to do with Solomon, are copper mines in Jordan from the time of King Solomon. And we know that King Solomon uses a lot of metal in the temple, but that's a very interesting thing. And the article basically went through different approaches, bringing in Finkelstein, who's saying, no, still holding to his party line, but also bringing in the new discoveries. Okay, so one more stop before we get to Kayafa. This is the city of David. Elat Mazar excavated in the city of David. She raised hackles because basically she said what she was going to find before she found it, which archaeologists don't like. And okay? She dug above the ancient Jebusite fortress, the Canaanite fortress, and she found a large structure that she dates based on pottery to the 10th century. And she says, who is somebody who comes in and builds a new palace 3,000 years ago? It must be King David. Now, this was controversial. A lot of people don't agree with this. Some people do agree with this. It's a site that, being Jerusalem, has gone through a lot of changes and conquests and destructions. So it's a complicated site. So it's not really exhibit A for us, but it is interesting to keep in mind, okay? But we are going to be going now to a small site that was discovered in the early 2000s and was intensively excavated for 6 years from 2007 to 2013. And it is called Chir B'Kayafa. And perhaps its biblical name is Sha'arayim. We're going to get to that. But before we get to that, just to understand where we are, right? This is the area that we're in, okay? The place that's probably most familiar to people here is Beit Shemesh, okay? So we are slightly south and somewhat west of Jerusalem. Okay, Gush Etzion, my hometown over here. Going out this way is going out towards the west, towards the coast. And this whole area around Beit Shemesh, right, this whole area is called the Elah Valley. Okay, the Elah Valley is a fascinating place. First of all, it's very fertile. So people have always lived here. It's great for agriculture. There's tons and tons of archaeological sites here. But it's also a fascinating place for archaeologists because it's a midpoint, right? It's in between. It's in between what? It's in between the mountains over here, okay, the Judean hills, which were taken over by the Israelites, by the Judeans, okay, and the coast, which is Philistine. And here are these guys, the Canaanites, stuck in the middle. And the Philistines want it, and the Israelites want it. Everybody wants it. And it's a great proving ground for questions of ethnicity and conquest and when did things change and who became powerful when. And that's why a lot of the sites here are actually some of the most interesting sites that are being excavated in Israel today. So that's just the general area where we are. But we are going specifically to Kayafa, okay, which is right above the Elah stream. Just two small things to look at in this picture. Okay. Anybody who's a little familiar with this area, you may be familiar with this road 375 that eventually will take you towards Jerusalem in this direction, 38 that will take you towards Beit Shemesh. Kayafa is between two important hills, Azekah over here, and down here, it's not on the map, but Socho over here. David and Goliath have their famous battle between Azekah and Socho. The Israelites and the Philistines are camped across the valley from each other, across this Elah Valley from each other. So this is a story that's already connected. This site is already connected with King David, with Philistines, with Israelites. Right? It definitely is not a foreign area to this time period, but we're going to take it a little bit further. Okay. Here's just a nice satellite picture so you can get a little bit of a sense of it in the valley, right? Here's Azekah, Socho is down here, and our site of Sha'arayim or Kayafa up here. Okay, in the early 2000s, there was a park ranger named Sa'ar Ganor, who basically was in charge of antiquities theft, not thieving, but finding the thieves. And he's patrolling around various sites, and he comes up on this hill called Kayafa, which nobody really knew anything about. And he discovers a few things. First of all, he sees there's a wall, which has like kind of small stones, not very impressive stones, but he can see there's a layer underneath of very large stones, right? That's already one thing, much larger, much more impressive looking stones. But the other thing he discovers, and you see it beautifully in this aerial view, is that there's an entire wall. There's a full circumference of a wall around this site, 700 meters of circumference. This is the only so far biblical period complete wall. That's a big deal, right? It's a complete wall from the biblical period. He's very excited about it. The other thing that makes this site really great is that except for a very short time period in Hellenistic times, right, fourth, third century of the before the Common Era, this site is a one period site, okay? It's settled, we're gonna talk about when, but give or take the time of King David for about four decades and then nothing. Okay, now a site that's only one period is really great for archaeologists because it's not confusing, right? You don't have to worry, does this come from this time, from this time? It's all from one time. Nothing's destroyed, nothing's rebuilt, nothing's renovated. It's all from one time. So all of these things, the whole wall, the fact that it's probably biblical period based on the size of the stones, that it's a one period site, Sa'ar Ganor sees this, he's very excited. He reports to the Antiquities Authority, and an archaeologist is assigned to dig there. Somebody named Yossi Garfinkel, a professor from Hebrew University, who up until then had been digging only in prehistoric sites, and he decides he wants to branch out into biblical sites. Today he's digging in Lachish, and he starts digging there in 2007 and digs till 2013. Now, just as a side point for a moment, when they stopped digging here, people who are into this stuff, tour guides, archaeologists, students, everybody was like, you have to keep digging more. Come on, come on. This is so great. But archaeologists today do not dig a site till they're finished in most cases. mostly because we are humble enough to understand that just as we laugh at early archaeology, which wasn't so good at preservation and made a lot of mistakes, the future is going to laugh at us, right? We are making mistakes, we are messing things up, and we don't want to uncover everything. We want to leave something for the future. So they dug here for 6 years. What they found, that's what we're going to spend the next little bit talking about. Okay, so first of all, like we said, discovers this complete wall. Now we're seeing it from the outside, and these are the large stones that you can see on the bottom. Later on, Arab shepherds came along and built a higher, built smaller stones and made the wall higher, but that's not important for our story. We want to cut away and understand from the larger stones and down. We're looking at it from the outside. In a couple of minutes, we're going to see it from the inside, where we're going to see it's a special kind of wall called a casemate wall. We'll get to that in a moment. Have no fear. Okay. Sorry, this is a spoiler. You're already seeing the entire site, and my surprise is going to be ruined, but it's nice to get a sense of the whole site. But basically, when they start to dig, they discover the very first place they start to dig is over here. And right away, they find a gate. And we're going to see that in a minute. Now, the other thing I want you guys to notice is that inside the wall are these strange little shapes, right? What are these weird? Forget about the gate. The gate is important, but that's the gate. But we are focusing on these, okay? Now, these are called casemates or sogarim, okay? Casemate means that you build houses into the wall. You build buildings into the wall to protect the wall, to make it a more secure place. Okay. And as you can see, the entrance to each of these houses is away from the gate, right? You see that? Right over here also, it's away from the gate. Now, one of the things that we're going to see that's going to be very exciting is that as the archaeologists continue to dig, they realize that the direction of the entrances shifted. And that's because we're going to find another gate. We'll get to that. Don't worry. Okay, but that's just our basic plan of the site. This annoying box has happened to me before, so I'm going to stop sharing for one moment and come back to it just because I don't want that to. Sometimes that works. We will try. Meanwhile, don't worry. I'll keep talking. I talk a lot. Okay. Let's just go back to this. From our current slide. Okay, so the gate, right? When they discovered a gate, that's not so unusual, right? For a biblical period, right? You would find, you would find a gate because cities are fortified. They have gates, right? Here's a view of the gate from the inside of the city, right? We're standing inside the city and we're looking out, okay? Now, one of the things that's special about this gate is it has four chambers, right? Four little rooms inside the gate. Rooms, chamber gates are things that we find in biblical sites, okay? Hatzor, Megiddo, Tel Sheva, sometimes four chambers, sometimes six chambers. It's a classic Israelite style. The casemate wall is also a classic Israelite style, okay? But we still have a big question. Whose city is this? Just because it has these qualities that make it Israelite doesn't necessarily mean it is Israelite, right? And that's our question that we're going to try to answer. We have two main questions that we want to answer about this site, about Caiapha. One question is, who is it? And the other question is, when is it? Okay? And not everybody agrees about the answers to those questions. But when they first uncovered this gate, they said, okay, this gate is facing towards the west. Okay? When you go out of this gate, out towards these hills, where are you getting to? If you keep walking for a couple of hours, you are getting to Philistine land. In fact, if you walk for 3 hours, you get to the enormous Philistine city of Gat. And we're going to come to that in a second. But if your gate is facing the Philistines, and you're assuming, we are assuming, as the archaeologist assumed in 2007, that you only have one gate, are the Philistines your friends or your enemies? Right? Our assumption is you're facing your friends. You want your most vulnerable point facing your friends. So when they found this, they said, well, maybe this is a Philistine site. That's not such a crazy idea, right? And here are our main Philistine cities, just to get a sense of where we are in relation to them, right? The Bible talks about five Philistine cities. Next time we're going to talk about the Philistines. Aza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gat. Where is Caiapha? Caiapha is right about here. Okay, not far from Gat. So the suggestion that this is a Philistine city, a very valid suggestion. We don't have any other proof yet, but the fact that it faces in that direction makes a lot of sense. Okay. Gat, Tel Asafi, major site. We're going to really talk about it much more next week, but very close by. Controls the whole area, super powerful, massive tell, okay, where they discovered all sorts of fascinating things, including an altar, including an inscription that says about on it in the script, the Paleo-Hebrew script, something that sounds like Goliath. We'll get back to this. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. But the fact that we are so close to the Philistines, maybe this is a Philistine city. But then they continued to excavate. Now, if you didn't get it so much in the drawing, hopefully this will make it even more clear to you. Okay, we have our gate, right? Here's our first gate that they uncovered. And right next to the gate are our casemates, our nice little rooms in the wall. And each one of them, the entrance is far from the gate, right? On the far side, because it's less vulnerable that way. Okay, when the enemy comes in, you want him to come around to get to you. Okay, now that's what's going on in this picture near the western gate. Everything is facing towards that side. But as I said, they eventually realize that the casemates shift, okay, shift direction. They're facing towards that gate and away from what it turns out is a second gate that is virtually identical to the first. It has four chambers. The four chambers are the same size. It has the casemates next to it. Okay, all of it is very connected. It makes a lot of sense. It all looks very nice, except now what are we talking about? This is not facing Philistine land. This is facing the south. Okay, in fact, this is Tel Sofa over here. Okay, south and towards the east, that is much more Judahite, okay, the tribe of Judah. So wait a second, maybe these are not Philistines. What's going on here? Now, the fact that there are two gates is a strange thing, right? A gate is a weak point. You don't want more than one gate. Don't think about Jerusalem and all the gates around the old city. That's for a much later time period. Biblical times, you almost always have one gate because it's hard to defend a gate and you don't want to have more than one. But indeed, we actually have a place in that is mentioned in Tanakh that is called Two Gates. Whoa, what does that mean, right? Sha'arayim from Mishkafayim, Ofanayim, right? Ayim means double, means two. And in the book of Joshua, where we have the very boring, but to tour guides and archaeologists, very interesting list of the areas of the different tribes, okay, it talks about the tribe of Judah, and take a look. In the lowlands, Bashfela, which is where we are in the valley, Eshtaol and Sorah and Asnan, Zanoch and Inganim, Tapuch and Inam, Yarmut and Adulam, Soho and Azeka, which we said are right nearby, and Sha'arayim. Okay, now, besides the fact that Sha'arayim, two gates, right, a Sha'ar is a gate, two gates fits with this site, it also fits in terms of geography, because in the book of Joshua, when they list the areas, they do it in geographical order, right? So Socha, Azeka, Sha'arayim, they do go together. They're all next to each other. Not only that, at the end of the story of David and Goliath, which is the part that most people, you know, have closed the book by that point, okay? But it's important. The people of Israel and Judah rose up and shouted and chased in the Philistines until Gat, and the gates of Ekron, and the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Sha'arayim, Derech Sha'arayim, right? But Derech Sha'arayim means the way to or from Sha'arayim. They're leaving from this area and going towards the west, towards the Philistine land. So is this Sha'arayim? So far, we haven't found the sign that says, welcome to Sha'arayim, but it does fit very nicely in terms of its having the two gates and in terms of its connection to Tanakh. But we still don't know exactly when it is or who it is. We don't have conclusive proof. So let's switch from who it is for a moment to when it is, okay? How do you know when something is from? So people love to say carbon dating, right? Carbon dating is very popular. Everybody loves carbon dating. Carbon dating is very nice, except for two problems, okay? Number one, carbon dating requires carbon, i.e. you need something that was once a living organism in order to test it. living organisms don't tend to last for thousands of years. Okay, that's a problem. When you find them, it's very exciting, but you don't often find them. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, carbon dating, as nice as it is, has a margin of error of about 75 years, which is kind of what we're talking about here. Is this King David, or is it the kings a little bit after, within the next century after him? So it's very tricky. Now, at Caiapa, they found four olive pits, okay? And they carbon dated them to between 1037 and 947, okay? Which does put them squarely in the time of King David, a little before, a little after, but not 100% proof. Also, there are only four olive pits. This is something Finkelstein loves to make fun of. He says, well, you're good basing everything on four olive pits. Give me a break, okay? But you take what you can get, right? But besides that, like I said with Petrie at the beginning, you look at the pottery, and the pottery fits with 10th century. So most people by this point in the excavations and today agree that this site is a 10th century site, right? The site from the time of King David. Have we agreed that it is belonging to King David? Not yet. Hold on. Okay, so now we're going to go back to our who is it? How do you decide who something belongs to? How do you determine ethnicity? Right. So people will sometimes say, oh, you know, you look for the mikvah, you look for the mezuzah, you look for the inscription. Those things are not often found. Mikvah, we do not have in First Temple times, we haven't found any yet. I won't say we do not have. Mezuzah is also not. A lot of times it's very difficult to determine ethnicity. How do we figure it out? So what do? We look at ritual objects, if we can find them. Also not so simple. The Israelites worshiped idols, just like everybody around them, okay? We look at architecture and urban planning, our casemate wall, our chambered gates, okay? We look at writing if we can find it. And we look at pottery. Again, pottery is really important. And what do I mean when I say pottery? I mean styles and I mean amounts. And that's the picture that I brought you here. What did I bring you a picture of? I brought you a picture of the big jar on the right. That is a beer strainer. Beer was very popular in the old days, just like today. But in the old days, they didn't strain out the hops, right? The barley that they made the beer from. So you needed to have a utensil that would pour out the liquid and keep the hops inside. So this is a beer strainer. Now, Philistines loved beer. And we find beer strainers, lots of them, in sites that are clearly Philistine sites for other reasons. Israelites, much less, right? All those old jokes about how Jews don't drink as much as goyim was true in those days, right? So when you find a certain type of pottery and a lot of it or a little of it, that also tells you something about the people. Again, to go back to my mother's kitchen being excavated in 500 years, when they uncover it and they discover five sets of dishes, do they say this lady really liked dishes? Or do they say, wow, this must be an Orthodox Jew who has dairy, meat, Passover, Shabbat, right? All those things, okay? So the types of dishes, the style, the amount, that also tells you something. Food tells you something. Israelites, interestingly enough, they didn't worry so much about idols, but they never ate pig. All the sites we have found that are Israelite sites, that are incontrovertibly Israelite sites, do not have pig bones in them. So with all this very lengthy introduction, what did they find in Caiapa? Okay, so they did not find pig bones. They found very few Philistine-style dishes, okay? We're going to see a few other things, but up until now, the ethnic markers that we're finding are Judahite, connect to the tribe of Judah. But remember, this is a very small area, okay? Across the road is Tel Beit Shemesh, which was Canaanite. Down the block is Tel Gat, which is Philistine. Are they not sharing, importing, buying things from each other? So it's a very tricky thing to determine ethnicity. Now here's where we find something else interesting, ritual objects. There were three, we're gonna see the other two in a minute. There were three of these little model temples that were discovered, okay? Now this one happens to be a lovely one made out of clay. We're gonna see an even nicer one in a second that's made out of stone. Here you go, on the left. What's fascinating about these, there are two things that are fascinating. These were found near the gates. Okay, gate is often a ritual area. There are two things that are fascinating here. Number one, shrines like this are found in Philistine sites, right? They're found in other places, but they almost always have a little idol inside. These did not have idols inside. Okay, now I said to you, Israelites did worship idols, but perhaps we're witnessing a transition. These did not have idols inside. The other thing that's fascinating is there is a marked resemblance to the temple in Jerusalem. Okay, take a look at this. Okay, take a look at the lintels within the lintels within the lintels. Now, the other picture I brought here is anachronistic, right? It's a picture from the Holy Land model of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. Second Temple, right? But it shows you these lintels within lintels. But more interesting is the verse that we have on top, right? The Book of Kings says the entrances to the sanctuary, right? This is King Solomon's temple. He made doors of olive wood, the doorposts within the frames having five angles, right? What does that mean? Five angles, okay? It talks about the aisle and the mezuzot. Now, the biblical commentary, the Radak, says the aisle is the lintel. That's the thing on top. The mezuzot are the doorposts that the lintel leans on. The doorway was in the design of five. The posts had five ribs, one within the other. Okay, describing pretty much what we're looking at here is what the temple, King Solomon's temple, looked like. Was this maybe an early model for a temple in Jerusalem? Maybe, who knows? We don't know, but it's another intriguing piece of evidence for our suggestion that perhaps this is a Judahite site. Okay, the best thing you can find that tells you who something belongs to is an inscription. And we have two very interesting ones in Caiaphas. One is a jug whose owner liked it so much that he wrote his name on it. Okay, and you can see it. You'll see it even better in the next picture, but you can see it here, right? But I'll show it to you in the next picture because you can see it much better. Okay, and if you can read a little bit of ancient Hebrew, right, it actually is pretty easy to read. Here's our Aleph starting at the right, of course, right? Here's our Aleph. No. Where's my annotating? Here's our Aleph. Here's our Ayin, right? Looks like a lovely Ayin, okay? Like an I. What does it say? It says, Eshba'a ben Bida. Eshba'a ben Bida. Who is Eshba'a ben Bida? We don't really know. But there are two things that are interesting about his name, okay? Number one, these letters that are written in ancient Hebrew script. Now, as we saw before, other peoples in the region used our script. So it's not 100% proof, but it's leaning in the right direction. The other thing that's interesting is the name, Esh Baal, Ish Baal, the man of Baal. Baal, of course, is a famous Canaanite god. We have a lot of Israelites who are named Baal because they followed the Baal. And who is the son, one of the sons of King Saul? His name is Ish Boshet. The man of shame. Trust me, his mother did not name him the man of shame. Okay, she named him Ish Baal, the man of the Baal. But the Bible was a little, you know, embarrassed by that and instead called him the man of shame. And we have the Book of Chronicles gives his other name, which is Ish Baal. So this is a name that is very likely to be an Israelite name. Okay, so we have those as on the side of being Judahite, Israelite. Okay, one more piece of writing. This caused a lot of press when it was found. This is another one of those pieces of clay, a straka, with writing all over it, okay? If you can't read it, don't worry. None of the scholars could read it either, okay? This is one of the suggestions of what it says, of what the letters look like, but there have been many suggestions of what it says, nothing conclusive, nobody really knows. All we really can say is it's written in this old Hebrew, in this Paleo Hebrew, but it doesn't give us much more than that, okay? So far, what do we have on the side of saying this is Judahite? We have a gate that faces Jerusalem. We have no pig bones. We have pottery that seems like it fits with our story. We have ritual items that seem like they fit. And we have early Hebrew writing. Do we have anything else? Okay, here's an interesting thing that the archaeologist actually did this. I was lazy and I did it on Google Maps, but you could do it too, right? How long is it to walk from our Caiaphas over here on the left to Jerusalem? And it's about a half a day's walk. Okay, 7.5 hours. It's about a half a day's walk. Could you have your capital in Jerusalem and this is your far outpost in the west? It certainly is conceivable. It's not that far away. It could be within the realm of the kingdom of King David. Okay, so you have great proximity to Jerusalem. All of these pieces, all of these factors put together made the archaeologists say, and not everybody agreed with them, that Caiapha, which is also Sha'arayim, which is also called the Elah Fortress by the archaeologists, seems to be a Judahite site, seems to be a site controlled by the tribe of Judah, meaning controlled by King David. Again, not everybody agrees, but we're going to talk about in a second what that means if it's true. Okay? Two last little things. Near the Western Gate, they actually discovered a cache of weapons, 3 iron swords, 10 daggers, an axe head, arrowheads. Now, if you know a little of your Tanakh, you know that in the time of King Saul, the Israelites are described as not having any metalworking capacity. They're not able to do it. The Philistines control, they monopolize metalwork, because they don't want the Israelites to make weapons. And even for their farming implements, right, for their plows and everything else, they have to go to the Philistines to fix them. It was a very humiliating situation. So are the weapons here showing us that this is really Philistine? Perhaps. But we also have found that the Israelites, it's not quite true. In Beit Shemesh, not far away, we discovered an Israelite metalworking workshop from around this time period. So it doesn't mean that this couldn't be Israelite, but it is an intriguing little piece of information. It also leads us to ask the question, what happened to Caiapha? Why did they leave? There was no battle. Why did they leave their weapons behind? We don't have answers to those questions. Okay, one last interesting artifact, lots of artifacts that were discovered, jar handles, okay? Jar handles are not particularly unusual. You find lots of jar handles. What makes these jar handles interesting is that you can see that each one of them has a little indentation, has a little imprint here, right? Can you see that? And you can see it in all of them, right? If you ever made those cookies where you put your thumb in the dough and then you put the jam inside, that's what this looks like, okay? Why would you do such a thing? Because jar handles, and we know this from later in First Temple times, jar handles were tax receipts, okay? The king's supervisor comes to you, says, how was your year? You have 300 jars worth of oil. Well, 10% of it goes to the king. I'm going to leave you these special jars that say on them, La Melech, to the king. I'll be back next week after you fill them up. Okay. Comes back. You get your handles as a receipt. That way you can prove that you paid your taxes. Is this a similar idea, right? Are these a very early form of tax receipts? And if they are, what that shows you is that you have a centralized government, an administrative center. This is a pretty sophisticated place, okay? So let's just sum up for a minute before we get to one last piece. If, and again, these are ifs, if this site is 10th century, and if this site is Judahite, okay? And if this site is controlled by King David, it is a strong, fortified city, far away from King David's capital, a half a day's walk from Jerusalem, even more from Hebron. It shows his power. It's on the edge. It's on the border. Okay, it shows that he's a powerful enough king that he can maintain a center that's not right in the heart of Judah, but on the edge. The other thing we see here is that we have walls, we have taxes, we have writing, we have an administrative center very early, okay, 10th century. Shows that we've shifted to a new stage. We've become more urban earlier than we thought we had, okay? So both of those things are fascinating. Perhaps we also have a precursor to the temple, okay, in that model. So a lot of different things, even people who don't agree about everything that the archaeologists say about Caiapha, everyone agrees that Caiapha is a game changer. That's a fascinating site that gives us a new idea of 10th century Judea. But the guys who excavate a few miles away in Tel Beit Shemesh say, no, 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 no. Caiapha is very interesting. It got to be on the cover of National Geographic, but we're the real story. Tel Beit Shemesh, unlike Caiapha, which is a blip, 30 years, 40 years, Tel Beit Shemesh is around for centuries upon centuries. It is a Canaanite city, then it's conquered by the Philistines, it's taken back by the Canaanites, eventually it becomes a large Israelite city. It has a sophisticated water system, okay? It has metalworking, like we said. This is the real story. this, when this becomes Israelite, this is the real story. This shows King David's power. That's what the excavators in Tel Beit Shemesh will say. One last piece of Tel Beit Shemesh, just because it's fascinating and people who follow archaeology in Israel may know about this. Okay, Tel Beit Shemesh has been excavated for a very long time. It was known about already over 100 years ago. And this is the site on the western side of Route 38 over here. And you can come and you can visit it. You can see it. It's still being excavated today. But a couple of years ago, the city of Beit Shemesh, together with the state of Israel, decided that their road was not wide enough. There are many, many, many people moving into the area. It's a big problem. Traffic is a huge problem. They want to widen the road. Now, before you can do such a thing, you have to do what's called a salvage excavation. You have to bring in the archaeologist to make sure there's nothing valuable there. Ah, it'll take a week, 2 weeks, it'll be over, we'll start to dig. Whenever you say that, you know you're in for trouble. The assumption always was that Tel Beit Shemesh was a powerful city for centuries upon centuries. And then when the Assyrians come, 7th century before the Common Era, they destroy it. And that's the end of Tel Beit Shemesh, and there is no more Beit Shemesh. Lo and behold, when the archaeologists started to dig on the eastern side of the road, this is what they discovered, a massive site that basically picked up where the site across the road left off. They finished in the 7th century, but the people of Beit Shemesh didn't give up. They just picked themselves up and they moved to the hill next door and they kept on building and they were there in the first temple times, second temple times, Byzantine times, Turkish times. It's an amazing site. Today, the city of Beit Shemesh is trying to figure out how to make the road go and still be able to preserve all the archaeology. It's a great story. But that is not our Kayafa story, but a little bit on the side of Beit Shemesh. So just a few photo credits, and I'm going to stop sharing, and I'm going to take a look at the questions in the chat, and if anyone has other questions. All right, let's see. Okay. Didn't some of the soldier archaeologists like Yadin and Dayan use army personnel on the digs, public resources, but kept many of the finds? Oh, who asked that question? That's a very controversial question. Okay, first of all, I don't think Yadin was implicated in taking anything. Dayan was famous for that. Dayan was famous for taking souvenirs home. I think Yadin had pretty clean hands. Using army personnel was not something that Yadin used in Masada, but he did very much, he and the other archaeologists who took part in it, did use in their study of the caves in the early 60s in the Judean desert. And they needed to, because there was no way to get, there was no access without the assistance of the army. So I would agree with the army personnel. I wouldn't agree with kept many of the finds. I studied with Professor Mazar, so cool. That would be great to hear more about that. I heard that Yadin and Dayan were walking the Roman road up north and were following Josephus Flavius, the Jewish road, on the road the Roman legions would have taken. Josephus, okay, this is the story of Gamla. It's a great story. Not exactly, Jerry. I would correct the story slightly. It wasn't Yadin and Dayan. It was Shmayahu Gutzman, post Six-Day War. And they described it. They discovered this mountain that really did look like a camel's hump. And they started to excavate and it really was Gamla. So great story. Slightly different version. Sharaim means two gates. What are there two of in Adataim? That's a good question. I don't know. And Ada, I don't know. Pig bones. Okay, we said pig bones. We answered that. Did ancients make their own pottery or did they buy them from locals? Okay, that's a great question. And that's part of the problem that we're dealing with here, which is, did you go to the local Target and get stuff? And everybody got from the local Target. So Canaanites, Philistines, Israelites, they all have the same pottery. Or was it made in-house? Sometimes you can answer that question by looking at the clay. You can actually, there are archaeologists who can analyze the clay and understand where it came from. But you can't always answer it. And for sure, there was import, there was export. We know about dishes that are even brought in from outside the land of Israel. So I would say yes and yes. They did make it, but they also did buy it. And not only from locals, but from outsiders. When they went to the Philistines for sharpening, they paid a pim, true. And we've actually found a pim. Okay, there is a pim in the Israel Museum, this weight that says on it pim. Wasn't Beit Shemesh where they wanted to dig a tunnel? Yes, we answered that question. Why no first temple era mikvot? Hi, Sarah Maslow. Of course, you're going to be asking the hard questions. So we have not found first temple era mikvot. That does not mean there weren't any, but we have not found them. Okay, so there are three possibilities here. Okay, number one is we haven't found them. They're there, we just haven't found them yet. Number two is they didn't use mikvah, despite the Torah talking about mikvah. They didn't keep that mitzvah, and that's a very interesting discussion altogether. What laws did they keep in biblical times, and what didn't they? The third answer, which I think is probably the most likely answer, is they did keep the laws of ritual purity, but they just didn't have mikvahs. They went down to the local spring, to the local water, whatever it was. It's a question that is still an open question. Mikvahot from Second Temple, we have all over the place. Thank you, Tova Shimon. Okay, I worked at Gama in the early 80s. So cool. That, by the way, you should know that many pre-army Israelis today and post-army still want to serve, to go and dig in archaeological excavations, and high schools dig, and archaeology is still a national pastime. Maybe not as much as in the 50s, but it's still important. Shaarayim does not mean two gates. I don't know why it would not mean two gates. You can explain. Okay, the requirement for non-mayim even was Dirabanan, right? Chana Weisler, you're trying to explain the mikvah question. Could you say that mikvahot from Second Temple were built on the site of the original mikvahot? That's interesting. I think there is somebody who does say that. But so far, we haven't found any insights that are purely First Temple sites. And Svi asked, is Shaarayim assumed to be a fort or a military garrison? That does make sense, right? It's an outpost on the edge. Okay, no Weinberger, we answered your question. Beit Shemesh, where they wanted to dig a tunnel and found the whole city. That's the whole thing with the road that they discovered. Time does always mean two. I don't know, always, I'm not a linguist, but I think it often does mean two. What I am saying is I don't know what the ada in ada time means, because I don't know it doesn't mean two of something. You have to look in the translations. Okay, other questions. Evidence of nomadic tribes nearby, like Bedouin? I don't think so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman.
Enjoy the coffee. Please, or whatever you have.
Water.
Yasher koach, very nice. Okay, felt a little bit like I'm in Israel, you know, a little bit on a teal. Not quite. Ain't no dom eshmiel l'ra'iyah, but.